You are listening to Faith is Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the rogue deck builder. Each week, we design new decks in Modern and Pioneer. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the roundup, a first look at the new meta after the BNR update, plus picks of the week in Modern and Pioneer. We also take a first look at a new command cycle from Strixhaven School of Mages. That's all coming up on episode 12 of Kaldheim Season. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joined after a one-week sojourn by Damon Alexander. Damon, what's going on?
Hey, fresh back from the slopes of Sun Valley, Idaho, where I spent a week skiing and shredding it up. Only had to call ski patrol once, so I consider it a successful trip, and it's good to be back.
Awesome. And we are joined, as always, by the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Dan Schriever. Dan, what's up?
Hello, hello. How are you, David?
I'm well.
I'm not sure what Ski Patrol is, Damon. It sounds like a band or something.
Well, it's the people who, if you like break a leg off a jump or whatever, they come in, like put you in a little sled and take you to the bottom of the mountain and treat you as the actual ambulance comes. And we decided to do this backcountry run. And my friend was like, oh, we have to just cut under the ski area boundary line and go that way. And I was like, okay, whatever you say, man. And then we do this and then we just kind of keep going and keep going. And I start pulling, at some point I pull up the topo map and it's like, where are we? Like, I think we need to get over that ridge line, but I wasn't really sure. And so I figured at that point, maybe we just call Ski Patrol because I had cell service. And then they were like, oh, yeah, if you just descend a few hundred feet, you'll hit a trail that will take you back, like a little path that will take you back.
It was a foolproof plan, Damon. What could go wrong?
Exactly. Well, yeah, what could go wrong is that you wind up, instead of descending down to the bottom and going up a chairlift, you descend down the bottom of a different valley. And have to figure out your way to a road or something. That's what could go wrong.
Well, we're glad you're back. You picked a heck of a week to be gone, Damon. This was like the calm after the storm, I guess. I mean, last week was insane in the Magic world.
Oh, my goodness. And storms across the whole country. Yeah, in addition. But yeah, I was getting my ski gear on Monday morning, ready for the first day on the slopes. And woof, in comes the BNR. That was a massive change. I thought you guys did a great job breaking it down. Now that we've seen it in action, it is definitely a change for the best.
Yeah, we'll need to get some of your quick thoughts on this, Damon. But before we do so, maybe we should take care of our housekeeping at the top.
Yes, we'd like to give a shout out to our newest patron, Robert G. Thank you very much for the support. Just a quick reminder, if you're interested in supporting us here at the Faithless Brewing Podcast, you can go to patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. And just a reminder that we are now releasing episodes twice per week, one on Friday, one on Sunday. Our episode today, you will be hearing about a roundup of the new meta in the post-ban world, as well as there all of a sudden are a few sneak peeks for the newest set of Magic, which is Strixhaven.
Yeah, that just snuck up on us. I can't believe how soon.
Yeah, they have very sort of uneven intervals of sets being released. We were with Zendikar Rising forever, but then the call them to Strixhaven interval is just much smaller.
And they're sandwiching in Time Spiral Remastered in March. I think they're just starting a quick preview season of that later this week. So it's super compressed.
Yeah, yeah. The good news in terms of, you know, financial impact is that because foils are complete garbage now, it's not so expensive when new sets come out. You sort of, you know, buy a mythic rare or two.
Or don't buy them. Just rent them on Magic Online in case something gets banned 1 week after release.
You mean that buying 3 Uros that I've literally never played with and probably never will play with was a mistake? Is that what you're saying?
You're still a Legacy fan, right?
I'm not even sure I can claim that anymore.
This newest set was actually very well designed. No cards have been banned in Standard. No cards are threatening to be banned in Standard. No cards have been banned in Pioneer or Modern, and no cards are threatening to be banned in Pioneer or Modern. So now, not that many cards are getting played. That's a totally reasonable problem. If every set was at this power level, Magic would be in a great place.
There was a card banned in Modern. Trickery was banned.
Oh, that's a shame.
So they roll back the workplace safety sign weeks without a banning back to zero.
Well, Trickery won't get banned in Pioneer or Standard anytime soon. So 2 out of 3 ain't bad. to quote Meatloaf.
And there's only a 2-week period where they destroyed Modern. It's not, not a big deal.
And they did it for science. So Damon, you're back. What is your overall takeaway from the BNR shakeup? You heard us talking with Arun Singh, Jiggy Wiggy of the Sierra Vitas podcast last week. We went into a great amount of detail about it, but Damon, I'm curious if you had any additional thoughts, whether about Modern, Pioneer, Legacy, or just the gravity of the moment as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like such a good decision by WotC across the board, basically. I watch people play these stupid like Primeval Titan teamer decks, and they just flooded out and died. I was like, this seems fair that they don't get to just use their mana base to do everything in the world. And all of a sudden, I lost a match to Tireless Tracker. Like, that's cool. I wish I was the one with Tireless Tracker on my side of the battlefield. I haven't really looked at Legacy too much, but I have to imagine that, banning Oko can only lead to good things. Nobody wants to play against that card. Dread Arcanist, it was a bit of a surprise to people who don't play Legacy, but it's just actually a lot better than it sounds when you have Ponder and Brainstorm in your deck. Makes Jace the Mind Sculptor look like it costs way too much mana comparatively.
That ban shocked me. I mean, that would be like banning, just pick any creature in Modern that costs 2 and doesn't impact the board until the next turn. Like, how can you ban a card like that?
Yeah, it would be weird to ban a card like that in Modern. But the thing is that this Legacy kind of blue-red or blue-red-green Delver deck has been at the top of meta for a very long time. And Wizards will never ban Delver. They'll never ban Brainstorm or Force of Will. And so they kind of had to knock something out, knocking out only Oko. They, the deck was super dominant with Ren and Six. So they banned that. Super dominant with Oko. They banned that. And then I guess they wanted to take it down a peg further. Because Arcanist just was such a good card advantage engine in Legacy with Days and Force of Will to protect it. We're used to playing it with like Thoughtseize, and all of a sudden you're at 8 life. You both have no cards in hand, and they're at 17. You have a Dreadhorde Arcanist in play.
They have an Uro that you Thoughtseize on your fourth Thoughtseize.
Yeah, well, no more Uros, at least. We'll have to try all over again with Dreadhorde Arcanist and Pioneer, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, there's been some interesting Arcanist lists in the Modern 5-0s, and I think the Rakdos Pyromancer list on Pioneer is looking pretty good right now, but getting ahead of myself slightly. So it sounds like 3 cheers from you for all of these bannings.
Yeah. I mean, the Pioneer side of things, left to see. I mean, obviously Teferi is, good to get Yi gone. I wish that my favorite Canlander on a format would ban Teferi or point him just because that card is so annoying. But I'm sure they'll get there someday. Speaking of Teferi Time Raveler, I actually lost to Teferi in the semifinals of a 7-point Highlander top 8 over a kind of correspondence MTGO league. And it's a good thing it was correspondence because all my opponents were in Australia, because 7PH also goes by the name of Australian Highlander.
Yeah, that's such an interesting format, because you told us about Canlander or Canadian Highlander. I was unaware that all these other nations, great nations of the world, have their own currencies, their own exchange rates on points.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like these Highlander formats just get extremely localized. Yeah.
So were you basically able to play your typical strategy? I assume you're playing Blue Moon.
Yeah, of course I play Blue Moon. But it doesn't feel as good in Australian Highlander. I snuck into top 8, with a 2% opponent match win over the 9th place person. So extremely close. And it's just it has a very combo focus compared to Canadian Highlander, just because it sort of feels a lot higher power with only 60 cards. You see your good cards a lot more often. Like a Dredge deck sees Bazaar or Baghdad just much more frequently. The opponent will have their Oko or Teferi, that much more often. And so a lot of the, Blue Moon counterspells, there's only one counterspell. And then you have, crap like Mana Leak or, Logic Knot, which sometimes just doesn't work. And so sometimes like the answers just don't line up. And sideboards help, but also like some people are like playing main deck Pyroblast in the combo decks because they go over the top of the aggro decks and they don't care if they have a dead card. And then they can always sideboard out the Pyroblast. So that's kind of concerning.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but Canadian Highlander is a 100 card, no sideboard format.
Exactly.
And now you're switching to 60 cards with a 15-card sideboard. I saw that even your top 8 opponent had Lutri in their companion zone, which struck me as crazy if it's a Highlander format.
Yeah. Lutri is like a free roll, except that they actually gave Lutri a point for that exact reason. And so one of your precious 7 points has to be devoted to this otter. And from what I saw of Lutri, he didn't seem like it was worth the point. Like there's other cards you could play, like, Force of Will's a point, Mana Drain's a point. These cards both seem much better than the sideboard Lutri.
But you can copy and draw 3 cards.
Yeah, but with Ancestral Recall, the problem is that it's 5 points out of seven.
Mm.
And so you could have a Lutra in your sideboard, or you could have like a Mystic Sanctuary in your main deck. And then you could also copy your draw three in a slightly different way.
True.
And how'd your playoffs turn out? I mean, you made top eight. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. My opponent was actually, I think, fresh off a victory of the Vintage Challenge. And so after a long day of cruising through that, they got to my match and were probably a little bit bored of crushing people. And game one was close. Game two, they, you know, whenever somebody main phases Tainted Pact on turn two, you know they're desperate. And I went in response, Ancestral Recall, Flusterstorm, your Tainted Pact, untap Blood Moon, and ended that match. Then round two, I won a fun, grindy game one. And then game two, they had turn one, you know, Noble Hierarch. Or sorry, turn one, Deathrite Shaman even. Turn two, Inquisition. Turn three, Teferi. And I entered Scoop Face pretty quickly with my Blue Moon deck. The Ionize I had was not quite fast enough. And then game three, I kept a iffy two lander on the play and just didn't draw lands. So these things happen. My opponent went on to win the finals 2-0. They were playing Esper Tempo, and so they get to play Teferi, the fun Raveler.
Well, semifinals ain't bad. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. It was a fun tournament. I think they're having another league starting in a few weeks, and it's super cool. It's like a free entry, and I think this Australian game store provides prize support, and it was a pretty well-run league. So if anybody wants to, you know, it's definitely not, you know, our normal Modern or Pioneer, but it's a fun variant format.
I'll definitely put a link in the show notes to, they had a nice top eight player profiles with deck lists and all that. And I think they asked each of the top eight players, you know, how would you change the pointing or how would you fix the format? So that's pretty cool just to see something that's a little bit community focused, player run, actively seeking feedback, that kind of thing. And they gave away an Underground Sea as the number one prize. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And Australians are really fun to talk to. They just have very different lingo. When you're like, when they're like, hey, mate, and you're like, what time zone are you? And you're like, wait, I don't need to ask that question. I know what time zone you're in.
Yeah, you got to get our podcast to break into that Australian markets. I'm counting on you. I'm sending you on a diplomatic mission. But anyway, enough about those pointed formats. Let's take our check-in and take the pulse, take the temperature of Modern and Pioneer. So, David, where should we start? Should we start in Modern? Should we start in Pioneer? What do you think?
Oh, we should probably do Modern first.
All right. So what's your sense of like what's been happening at Modern since the BNR?
I think the power level has come down significantly in the format, which allows a lot of the like mediocre jank to succeed, because if Burn is the best deck, it's actually kind of easy for almost any color combination to have a chance against them. Native life gain strategy is obviously very powerful. Like Damon said, when you actually watch blue decks, they don't like every fetch land doesn't get to draw Cryptic Command or whatever. And you can play Blue Eye Control because you don't automatically lose to someone playing a tapped colorless land at any point in the game.
Yeah, yeah. And I was concerned that like Red Black Pyromancer and Hammer Time being two of the better decks pre-ban would become the two best decks post-ban. But Dave was mentioning how, well, this ban seems to encourage, you know, Jund or you know, Blue Eye Control even. And I think those decks do well against, you know, Red Black Shadow and Hammer Time. And so the meta actually seems to be so far to be pretty balanced.
I do think that there's probably a number one best deck in the form of green white company. And I don't have the hard stats on this from like mtgmeta.io or anything to back this up yet, but it's always felt like that deck has been just like knocking at the door of being just a cut above the others. Now that the blue decks have been knocked down slightly, and David, you're saying some people are trying to go aggressive again, trying to, you know, attack your life total again, the Heliod Company decks will just run away with those matchups. I do want to give a quick shout out here to David Helfenstein, also known as Mr. Rabe on Magic Online, longtime listener of this podcast as well. Fantastic brewer and streamer. He destroyed the Sunday Challenge, and he's just been crushing with the Heliod Company for a few weeks now. I think he said he was like 36-4 or something, or like a 90% win rate with Green White Company over 40 matches. And he was saying this like before he won the challenge on Sunday, and then he streamed the whole thing and just crushed it. His build is actually a little bit different. He plays, instead of Arbor Elf and Utopia Sprawl, he plays Noble Hierarch and Birds of Paradise. And he has on his Twitter feed a nice explanation of just sort of what are the trade-offs there. It has to do a lot with Archangel of Thune and just the upsides of having more hits off company, easier to get your mana sources. So just a great accomplishment for Mr. Rabe. And it's just nice to see someone who's like a brewer at heart. When the moment arrives, this is a concept, green-white Archangel combo, that he's been working on for almost 2 years now. But to see it converge with a deck that is both very good and very well positioned, and see him be able to take it down with his own spin on it, it's just awesome to see.
Yeah, and the finals was a mirror match against another Heliod Company deck, and they also got second in the Saturday Challenge. So yeah, this deck is the real deal, and yeah, it was a very strong deck before the ban and only better post-ban, but it is the true esports deck of Magic because this deck requires a lot of clicking. StarCraft has this metric that they measure players by called APM, or actions per minute, on the theory that if you can simply click your Marines or whatever faster, then they will naturally move in a better fashion than your opponents, and you will cruise to victory. And so I think really it's the same story with Heliod Company.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe him winning has more to do with him being just an excellent pilot. I don't know that it's the best deck. I think that's not obvious. There were two green-white Heliod Company decks in the entire top 32 of the Modern Challenge. So it might just be a point in the favor of, like you say, Dan, someone who's mastered this archetype. He's made iterations that no one else has because he understands it so deeply, and then has exploited his deep knowledge of the format to just pick the perfect time to play the perfect deck.
So other tidbits that stuck out to me were that some of the decks that we postulated might be dead, a lot of people had the same questions and decided to just try it anyway. So Ad Nauseam was one that we thought maybe either couldn't survive without Simeon Spirit Guide, or would need to pivot to Thassa's Oracle, Demure Inverter, Spoils of the Vault type plan. And both of those things are somehow true. Like the Inverter deck, I think, is getting more common, but someone managed a 5-0 with just like a classic Ad Nauseam without Spirit Guides. That was very, very weird. You basically just can't do Lightning Storm anymore, but that's okay. You don't need to. Apart from that, I was wondering what would be the top end finisher for control decks, and I thought maybe Scapeshift would see a big resurgence, and anecdotally at least, that seems to also be the case. A lot of Scapeshift showing up in both ramp and control shells. But diversity continues to be the name of the game. So I think in that spirit, we're going to do picks of the week in both formats this week, just to sort of celebrate the new metagame post-BNR. David, do you want to get us started with your pick of the week for Modern?
Yeah, my pick of the week had two finishers over the last couple of weeks, and it's basically, it's Aspiring Spike's list, but the names that are called out in these links are not Aspiring Spike. It's a Bant Stoneblade list that's playing Tusky, Bearer of Secrets, a card that I think we widely derided on our podcast. I can't even remember who was highest on it because we were all down on it. So who was least down? I don't know. The card 5-0'd in, like I said, these all look like card for card copies of his list. So if there's any one extra piece of tech that one of these players is playing, I do apologize. But it looks to be card for card. And yeah, it's just a Stoneforge list that's trying to take advantage of, the Stoneforge, Ice Fang, Quaddle kind of interaction, Teferi, Spellqueller, and then you have Toski to turn those creatures into more cards. And other than that, it's exactly the sort of Bant list we've seen a bunch of times. It is slightly more controlling. It is playing Force of Negation, a few counter spells. And On Thin Ice is tech that Spike has been in love with forever. He doesn't like playing Mana Leak with Path to Exile. Obviously, anti-synergy there. There are a bunch of cards, actually, that do kill Toski, so it's not like it's absolutely unkillable. But yeah, he's a big believer in this card. It still seems a little awkward to me, but it's having a lot of success.
I still don't get it.
Yeah, me either. I mean, I get that the deck itself seems strong, but it always seems like it must be this winning in spite of Toski, not because of Toski.
Yeah, I look at this and I feel like you could replace Toski with any other card and have a better deck, but I haven't watched any matches with this, so what do I know?
Toski being an indestructible blocker has come up a bunch of times, just kind of wild. Like, you play it, you attack with your Ice Fang Quaddle or whatever, and then it always is going to block their, giant Death Shadow or whatever for a turn. That's all I can say about that. I'm not sure I believe it myself, but Spike's convinced, and he has a way of finding value in these cards, so maybe this is a card that should be explored more.
I'm struggling to think of something complimentary to say to the pageant winner. Like, great job, Toski. I mean, here's what it is. Like, it's a Bant show. You got the Stoneforge package. You got some removal, some counter magic, your Ice Fangs, whatever. You wouldn't play Toski if you didn't have access to Ice Fangs and, you know, evasive creatures like Spellqueller, I'm assuming. Compare this to something like the Bant Blade with Cosima that someone like Kelvin Chu was playing. And he did 5-0 with that, and then he keeps iterating on it. I think he has now replaced the Cosimas because he said they kind of sucked and replaced them with Tireless Tracker. It just seems like there's like a slot for some kind of value card. And if you want it to be Toski, that's fine. If you want it to be Tireless Tracker or Cosima, that's fine too. But I just don't see how like any of these cards are like really perfect for this deck.
Well, Cosima is unplayable garbage. I could maybe be talked into Tireless Tracker, but if you're going to compare it directly to Tireless Tracker, then I actually think Toski is better, if that's the actual card I'm supposed to compare it to. Like, Toski's very likely to draw a card the turn it comes into play for no extra mana and always block. And in a format with a ton of red, that matters. Tireless Tracker is always going to die, right? It's almost never going to live against a red deck. And you're going to have to pay 2 mana to draw your card.
True.
And, you know, I think Toski is really bolstered by the existence of Stoneforge Mystic. If it, you know, one of the ways to deal with these decks before, because they do flood out because they're playing, you know, 4 Noble Hierarch, is you just kill all their creatures and you're just left with this equipment that doesn't do anything. But if you have a live body, and of course, Path to Exile with Soulscar Mage in play, Burn actually kills Toski, et cetera, they're Liliana minus. But if you don't have those cards, then eventually it just gets strapped up with the 2 swords and the Batterskull, and then it's pretty tough to lose.
So you're saying that Toski is like this tracker name nemesis or something?
God.
He's just the ultimate survivor, man. It's like a cockroach that comes out after the nuke, and it's like whatever weapons are lying around, he's the only one that can wield them.
I mean, I put a lot of equipment onto a true name nemesis, and okay.
So it'll be interesting to see if this has lasting success. I have not seen a lot of Cosimos in the 5-0 lists. And I think the banning of Uro has something to do with that. So,
yeah, I mean, if people bring in Plague Engineer to put it on a squirrel, then we know we're in a new meta then.
All right, Damon, on to you. What's your pick of the week in Modern?
Yeah, so this is a super spicy, you know, deep in the tier 3 deck that had some success this week. This is Blue-White Control that got first place in the challenge. That is basically the exact same deck I played in, you know, a couple of 1Ks several years ago. It has some upgrades, you know, with Teferi Time Raveler wasn't around back then. Archmage's Charm, Force of Negation, Shark Typhoon, Aether Gust. Okay, these are upgrades. But I mean, this deck is still a Cryptic Command, Supreme Verdict, Celestial Colonnade, Field of Ruins, Snapcaster, Jace. You know, even has like the single Oust. I played a single Oust, you know, years ago. And it was like sometimes you just draw the Oust and it's pretty good. This deck is beautiful. There's no Uros or Renin Sixes, Omnath. There's not this crappy, you know, things that the dark side of control where they start going into like soupy four color stuff. It's just straight, clean, blue eye control. All the cards here are to neutralize your opponent's threats or steadily uptick in value. And this deck really teaches you to quickly be able to go uptick to Teferi, Brace Chainstorm, activate Colonnade, move to combat, attack, pass a Tef 5 trigger, your turn. As you watch the round timer dwindle deep into the third game. But once you get into that rhythm, it feels good. So I'm very excited to see that this deck is back.
Yeah, main deck Timely Reinforcements. Obviously, that's an important card. If mono red or blue red prowess or black red, it's going to be everywhere. Yeah, I mean, there's been a big debate about the Celestial Colonnade, how many Field of Ruins to play. And, well, for this tournament, 2 Celestial Colonnades and 4 Field of Ruins was the right number.
Yeah, I heard you on the pod last week, trashing Colonnade. I literally thought of this deck. I was like, man, I used to play this in Modern. It's a pretty good card. It just kind of cleans up, and it's, you know, a tapped dual land, you know, obviously can hurt, but it's a trade-off people have been making for a long time in a lot of formats to fix your mana. And this can just randomly kill people. It kills Planeswalkers. It can block in a pinch. So I'm excited to see that Colonnade is back.
And Glacial Fortress is back too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, hearing you trash the Ren and Six Omnath, I was like, man, you're not going to like my pick of the week. I also picked a control deck, and I'll just mention it now so we can maybe think through the comparison and contrast. This was a list that finished X2 in the challenge, piloted by Moksha. It actually had a couple different finishes in the challenges and the leagues. It's a Bring to Light control deck, 4-color Omnath pile. This is what we used to know as 4-color Uro pile, except it no longer has Uro, it no longer has Mystic Sanctuary, it no longer has Field of the Dead. What's left? Well, it's just a pile of control cards. I mean, that's all the deck ever really was. So all you kind of have to do is replace those with some other control cards. Now, Moksha's build is a little bit spicy, in the sense that its top end is 3 Bring to Lights, 1 Scapeshift with a Valakut for it to find, and 1 Tybalt, rather, 1 Valky God of Lides. So when you draw your Bring to Light, you can assess, you know, am I ready to win this turn and, you know, go for the Scape Shift? Or do I just want a Niv-Mizzet Reborn type value card in the form of Bring to Light for Tybalt, which you can still do. And if neither of those are good, you can, I guess, Bring to Light for an Omnath. But I mean, apart from this, you know, it's just all your old friends. Remands, Force of Negations, Cryptics, Growth Spirals, Ren, Teferi, Bolt, Path. There's even a couple Explorers here. What do you guys make of this style of deck?
Well, Canister, I think, was playing this in the challenge on Saturday. And yeah, he was one I actually watched just kind of flood out. This deck plays 28 lands, and sometimes you just draw a lot of those lands, and you no longer have Uro to make advantage of those situations or Field of the Dead. And so that makes this deck, it used to be a pretty tilting deck to play against because you can maybe fend off their Scapeshift lines with the right counter spells, but meanwhile they have an Uro, they're interacting with all your stuff. So it's nice to have this deck be good, but not super, you know, annoyingly good. It's nice that it has weaknesses now.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of all the people who piss and moan that Splinter Twin is banned, but you can still basically just play Splinter Twin. So they just want Splinter Twin to be the best deck in the format, but you can play exactly the same cards and just play a 5-mana 2/2 instead of a 4-mana enchantment. So they act like they can't play at all. It's like, oh, you don't actually care about Magic at all. You just want to play, you want your deck to be the best. This is exactly like that. You're just playing the same exact style of deck. It's just way, way worse. Acceptably, it's acceptably powered now. You know, I'm sure an excellent player, Moksha very well may be one, you know, finds sweet lines. There's a bunch of different ways to win. You still get to play Omnath, Bring to Light, the Scapeshift, you know, as the one of, and two Valakut. You're still sacrificing some stuff in your mana. It's asking you to do all the normal things Magic is. It just isn't giving you free wins in your lands anymore, and you don't get to play Earl, so you get basically no value out of your graveyard. Like, this is exactly a perfect outcome of the bans, I think. This deck is eminently beatable. You can even out midrange it. It's not even that hard. You can actually get them with Blood Moon, which you somehow like couldn't get the other list sometimes. Like, this is beautiful. This tells you that the bans worked.
What if it turns out that this is still the best deck?
I was just told Green-White Heliod is the best deck, and I can't imagine this deck has an even close to a decent matchup against it. So as long as they don't ban Walking Ballista, I feel safe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm being somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, some players who will just play this type of deck forever. I saw Doomswitch tweeted a list like this without the BTL Tybalt thing and was like, oh, we broke it again, the best deck in the format. I had no idea whether that was a parody tweet or whether he was actually serious. But it was just like, What did you break? You just replaced the banned cards with some random Teferis. And it's like, okay, if this pile is still too good, then I'm sick of Triomes and I'm sick of Force of Negation. I mean, it's not lost on me that all three of our decks were Force of Negation decks. I don't really see why we still need these free spells in the format. But it's still like a pile of cards that are just like giving you a little bit more than you used to get out of cards. So I don't know. I mean, am I crazy? Am I prejudiced against blue decks?
I mean, I don't think this deck is that good.
I would say that really I think Teferi Time Reveler should go for Modern too. The reason why you need Force of Negation in blue decks is because you cannot let your opponent resolve a Teferi. And so you just have to have something that works on your opponent's turn. And it's balanced in the sense that it counters Teferi but doesn't protect a Teferi from being countered. But that's just kind of a stupid game to be playing.
I'll take that trade. I mean, if you'll let me ban Force of Negation and Teferi at the same time. You can take Wilderness Reclamation too, because without Teferi, I'm sure Wilderness Rec would run unchecked in Modern.
Well, I think that honestly, like, Force of Negation isn't really what these decks want to be playing. They don't like it having a 2-for-1 themselves.
Yeah, it's not played in high numbers. It just kind of annoys me philosophically that this card gets a free pass. But I understand that I'm the only one who feels that way.
I mean, all the forces are free, though. I mean, do you want to ban the green force?
Yeah, I mean, if it comes to that, yeah. Obviously, they printed them recently, so they disagree with me.
It is nice you play Pioneer, and if your opponent's tapped out, you know, they're tapped out. In Modern, they're tapped out, and then boom, Ravenous Trap.
I mean, there didn't used to basically be a control deck at all in Modern 2 years ago. So I think that there is a place to, like, play these slow, ponderous threats and incrementally win the game. Now, Damon likes to sort of the classic blue-white deck, which I think has to have an amazing matchup against these kind of lists. You know, I think these kind of decks should exist in some capacity if we need to ban certain cards from them. I mean, we're a week in, and this deck did not have anywhere near the showing that Green-White Heliod Company did, so I guess I'm not going to start sweating that this deck is broken or we need to start banning cards again. I would also add, because they ban like a ton of cards, they won't be banning anything in Modern for a really long time.
That's true. I'll just learn to love these decks.
I mean, you can always just play one green mana Cryptic Command if you really don't like blue decks. Like, you could put four on your sideboard, you could main deck one if you really want.
Oh, yeah, you could probably play some Teferi, Time Ravelers. That card's really good against blue decks.
Yeah, then you could put four Force of Negation in. I mean, you just play Bant with all the tricks.
Maybe get a squirrel in there to draw some cards.
Yeah. But yeah, Teferi Time Raveler is the problem and the solution at the same time somehow. Like, you can't play these, like, Bant lists, like the Squirrel Blade list. If you resolve anything and they eventually resolve Teferi, like, most of your deck doesn't work. Teferi just turns off 20 to 30 cards in huge swaths of decks. It's crazy.
Yeah. So, speaking of winning the game in small increments, we can shift over to Pioneer. Pioneer had a huge metagame shakeup. The BNR knocked out the entire Wilderness Reclamation archetype. It knocked out the Oops All Spells deck and took two cards away from Niv-Mizzet, possibly the best deck at the time. Five-color Niv lost Uro and Teferi. What's left? Well, my sense from playing Pioneer is that control is really, really good right now. But David, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the first week and a half was all aggro, and so it's easy to build the mid-range piles that brewers like to build. I include myself, I include Will Urker, I include a bunch of other people, and feel like the format was rejuvenated because you could do that all again, and it's easy to make a deck that's a little bigger than aggro that beats it. But I think people are just back to playing like little kid Urien lists where it's just like removal spell, removal spell, removal spell, Urien blink all my removal spells because they were staple to enchantments or creatures or whatever. And that chases out all of the aggro lists. So I think we're back at a point where you can't build mid-range lists again. And you either have to play counter spells, or you have to be very low to the ground with Thoughtseize, or you have to be super fast like mono red or mono green planeswalkers.
Would you say that Niv is still the best deck?
I actually think mono green planeswalkers is the best deck. I don't think Niv-Mizzet can beat the best draw for mono green on the play ever. But I think in a vacuum, like if you told me I had to 5-0 a league, I would play a control list that plays Bind to the Gods. I don't know if it would specifically have Niv-Mizzet.
Yeah, and there are some new options now. I'm seeing a lot of Velky decks in Pioneer, both in the dumps and people just tweeting out, oh, I 5-0'd or I did well in Challenge with this. Bring to Light for Velky is like a pretty good plan. And we're also seeing the release of the Winds configuration. You highlighted a list 2 weeks ago, David, from Mental Misstep. That player top forward again in the challenge. So I would expect to face a lot of control of all different stripes. But just in terms of percentages, it looked like five-color Niv was still about 20% of the winner's metagame in the challenges over the weekend.
Yeah, so one thing to highlight with like the release the win configuration is it's a deck that plays counterspell, and it also wins the counterspell wars if you're playing another deck with counterspells, because it gets to play Thoughtseize, Duress after board. So that was one of the reasons why I like my list against the old format. You're just really well positioned against those lists, and you just have to find a way to not lose to aggro. Yeah, so it's well positioned in the quote-unquote control mirror, if you want to think of it that way. Sure, it has creatures that die to Fatal Push, and they always kind of will. But you can also just wait, play all your normal stuff. You have a little bit of an edge, so I do think that we're at a place, though, where you just can't play these mid-range lists anymore. I think that was fool's gold for, like, 10 days. Like, people were playing, like, 4-mana Vraska, and I can do this, and I can play Saruf, and it's just like, no, you can't do that. That's all garbage. Like, it's not even close. They make the removal spells are just so good, and you just play them up the chain, and then they just have these 4 and 5-mana cards that just recoup all this advantage, so there's just nothing to be done about it, if you don't have counter spells.
Yeah, I think that Phoenix is actually back. I saw a couple of Phoenix results in Leagues and Challenges, and was inspired to dust off my old Phoenix build with Metamagic Channelers, and yeah, it was really good. I almost 5-0'd. I went 4-1, and I lost just by getting decked by a Vampires player who had left all their Leyland of the Voids in their sideboard, which is very weird because there's not a lot of graveyard action happening in Pioneer right now. But it worked because the Phoenix deck can grind, it has recursion, and it has counterspells. The biggest change I made was adding a full playset of Izzet Charms, whereas before I just had strategic plannings, because you got to be able to win these counter wars and, you know, counter their dig through times and that kind of thing. Counter their extinction events.
And your creatures are resilient to their wrath, right? Like, playing Dreadbore against Phoenix is not that good. Right. You already took three, you blow up their Phoenix, you play Bind of the Gods on it, and the Phoenix comes back. I mean, each time you're hitting them for six, you know, damage, and they do eventually die. I mean, they don't actually play ways to win or blockers or anything.
So we have three picks of the week in Pioneer. Damon, let's start with you.
Yeah, so my pick is Dragon Tempo by Control Freak 1992, so I guess a little bit younger than me, but with a similar love of blue-red decks. And even though I swore off Silumgar Scorn after a recent forays with it, it's apparently really good with Goldspan Dragon. And so this list features four Goldspan Dragon, and then it just kind of loses focus from there with a couple of Glorybringers, a couple of Niv-Mizzets, and then all of a sudden we're into the, you know, Hornswoggles and Rouse Outbursts, Storm's Wrath, and even a Dragon's Horde, a couple of Haven of the Spirit Dragons. So like this list is just all over the place. There's even like, you know, Filigree Familiar in the sideboard for your little 2/2 artifact gain life draw card friend. I had to look at what Hornswoggle did. I didn't know. It's a 2 and a blue counter spell, creature spell, make a treasure. But any deck that plays Rouse Outburst is near and dear to my heart already.
The list looks really, really rough. And yet on the Pioneer subreddit, the pilot posted about it. They went 5-0, 5-0, 4-1 with it. So I guess they're like doing really well. But some of these one-offs are crazy.
Yeah, so I mean, I think what they did is they just went way bigger. And so they realized, like, I'm just going to beat all the other control decks. They're playing way more counter spells. They cut all the one mana interaction. They cut down on Bonecrusher Giant. And yeah, they're equipped to beat decks that are trying to resolve, you know, Binding of the Gods on 4 and then like put a Urien in your hand on turn 5 and then try to blink stuff on turn 6. Like, they're going to fade a deck like that really hard. And Niv-Mizzet Perun is actually insane against these decks that don't even play other Gust anymore.
Yeah, yeah. There's other similar lists that play Sprite Dragon, but for all the reasons David said, Sprite Dragon is a pretty dangerous game to be playing against decks that do play Dreadbore.
Yeah, I played a similar list to this. I did play 4 Sprite Dragon. Yeah, that card's bad. I won't be playing that again. You do need to play at least 8 dragons. So they decided to play 4 more fun dragons. I was playing Kiora. I really think lists should consider that. Kiora is, I think, just better than Dragon Horde most of the time. You draw the card without having to tap it, so it makes mana and draws a card that turn. Silumgar Scorn is insane with Goldspan Dragon, which I actually think is better than Glorybringer now. There's nothing for Glorybringer to kill again. But yeah, every time I just boarded out the 4 dragons in almost every matchup. It's bad against aggro because they have cheap stuff that kills it. It's bad against control because they have, you know, Fatal Push or whatever else. So like, what is it good for? It's just a dragon. So if you're going to do that, just put some Niv-Mizzet Perunes. The other direction I'd like to try is to play a Grixis list where you get to play Thoughtseize and Counterspells. And then you get to play Nicol Bolas as one of your dragons.
Yeah.
So I've actually was drawing up a list like that over lunch, but it's cool to see decks like this that understand, like, okay, the tempo-y dragon list can't get there because of how much removal everyone's packing. So I'm just going to like play cards that are way more resistant to removal and play way more counter spells. I'd also like to see maybe a Shark Typhoon in this list as well, just as a flash threat or, you know, I mean, you can get an 8-8 with your dig through time.
Yeah. One card I'd like to see explored in this list, or maybe we'll have a Goldspan Dragon Week, is Alrun's Epiphany, the 4 blue-blue, take an extra turn, make 2/1/1 birds, also with Foretell. Sorry, it costs 7 mana without Foretell, 6 mana with Foretell. And that card has been somewhere between good and dominant in Standard. There was a teamer deck featuring 4 Goldspan and 4 Alrun's Epiphany that I believe won the challenge over the weekend.
Well, what I don't like about that is that it forces you to tap out more or less. I mean, maybe you, if you have the Goldspan and some extra treasures, you're not tapped out. But I think this list succeeds because it never has to tap out. You know, you play the Goldspan on 5 and you get your treasure back. And it's like you played a Teferi 5 and untap 2 lands. Whereas when you're trying to resolve Alrun's Epiphany for 6 or 7, they're going to Mystical Dispute it.
They aren't, though. No one's playing any counter spells. I'll talk about that in when we get to my list. But like, it's all just little kid, like, removal spells. I actually really like that, Damon. And you can tap out on turn 2 because there's no Teferi anymore. So it's not like there's, even on the draw, there's no play from these Binding the Gods lists that actually threatens you on 4 at all. You can just let them do whatever they want. All they can do is bring to light 4 times and their deck literally has nothing left to do. So it's actually kind of sweet. Just tap out on 2. I love that people are starting to play all these Foretell cards. They're actually really good in Pioneer now. And both the Counterspell and the Scry 2, Draw 2 are awesome once your dragon puts 2 mana in play. Like, if they don't have a removal spell, you just draw 2 at the end of their turn.
Well, speaking of, why don't you tell us about the deck that you've picked up for us?
Yeah, so if everyone's just going to play, like, Little Kid Urien stuff, then you should just go way over the top of them. And Killer SUV, he'd probably move to the suburbs and his wife made him buy it. is playing a Emergent Ultimatum list. So Emergent Ultimatum is a card that has seen a pretty reasonable amount of play in Standard. They're just getting value plays. It's worth noting that Emergent Ultimatum in Standard, often Valky is one of the cards that you pick. And so they, you know, if they give you Valky, then you get to cast Tybalt. But this doesn't worry about nonsense like that. That's not even close to good enough. Emergent Ultimatum is picking Enter the Infinite, Jace Wielder of Mysteries, and Omniscience, and you have to pick Omniscience and Jace or they win. And when you do that, they've got all these tutors. This list is playing three Grim Tutor. I've seen a bunch that are also playing the Fae of Wishes. And so they Grim Tutor for free, and they just get their Enter the Infinite and win. It happened to me. I didn't really know what they were doing. I had them down to like, I had them to four, so they had just enough life to Grim Tutor one time. And another time I had them down to exactly one. Yeah, it's super sweet. The deck also plays Nissa, who helps you like ramp to Emergent Ultimatum while you're pressuring Planeswalkers or making blockers. And it plays the best card in Pioneer, which is Sylvan Caryatid.
What? Okay. All right. It is the glue that holds together a lot of these decks.
Yeah, it also is like an amazing blocker. The other than the black trial, there's basically no way to kill it in the format. In mid-range matchups, you can't leave any removal in or anything, so it just lives forever. And it's awesome. It lets you turn two Binding the Old Gods. It lets you like Growth Spiral after you block at the end of turn, and it helps fix all the terrible mana in Niv. This is by far the best card in Pioneer, I think. I don't think it's close.
Thraben Inspector has been eclipsed. Thraben
Inspector's been replaced.
So if you drew up this list and presented it to me, I'd be like, you have no chance. How do you beat Interaction? And looking at this list, it's like, well, yeah, they thought of that. They just put some Interaction in their sideboard. But I guess they're just assuming that in the main deck, you don't need any of that stuff. You're just going to ramp, and do your thing. And no one's going to stop you.
Well, that's why these Dragon lists are killing. Like, this list is just dominant. Dominant over every Niv list, every other Binding the Old Gods list, every Urien list. That you can't literally do anything. It's just, that's a buy. That's 100%. But these Dragon lists are like, all right, you guys are just getting bigger and bigger and just not playing any Interaction. Like, I'm going to resolve a 5-mana Dragon, and then the game is literally over. Like, how do you like that? It's worth noting that Binding the Old Gods somehow, like, they get to attack the dragon first, so there's always a treasure up. But Binding the Old Gods does not trigger a Goldspan Dragon. I think it has to actually be targeted by a spell.
Yeah, it also doesn't trigger Niv-Mizzet Perun. So somehow Binding the Old Gods is a much better card than we thought.
I thought it was really good.
Yeah, but it appears to be, I guess, I think even better. It is apparently like a multi-format all-star now.
Yeah, the ramp ability, the fact that it interacts positively with Urien, the fact that it finds a Triome, so it actually fixes your mana, and the fact that it's a Niv-Mizzet hit, and the fact that it interacts with Enigmatic Incarnation, all those things make it useful. And again, it's very agnostic about permanent type, so you can't play any cute like enchantments or whatever to get around it. Your opponent just kills it, doesn't care. They don't care if you're trying to do anything cool, it's just dead.
So my pick of the week is a totally different style of deck. It is a Boros Dwarf Vehicles deck piloted by Soul MBA Airwave to a 4-0 result in a prelim and a 5-0 in a league. I think this might be the same as ConnorMan11, who's been streaming this. Over on the Seer and Visions podcast, they were talking about a version like this during their Vehicles week. So how does it work? Well, you have two giant vehicles, Consulate Dreadnought and Colossal Plow. These are both Crew 6. In order to crew 6, you have Giant Ox, the 06, that can crew with its toughness. So we understand that's a package. It's just a question of, like, what do you have to surround that with to make this actually function? And it turns out that the successful formula was to play mostly aggressive dwarves. Toolcraft Exemplar, Magda Brazen Outlaw, those are both 4-ofs. Veteran Motorist, also a 4-of. And 3, SRAM Senior Edificer, who is a dwarf who does draw off of vehicles. Although, you know, you probably won't be drawing that many cards with SRAM. It's just a supporting player here. There's also 3 Lurrus to buy back anything that you needed that died. Another interesting card is Peacewalker Colossus. This is a 6-6 for 3, crew 4. But it also has an activated ability of 1 and a white. It can turn on other vehicles, so it can kind of crew other vehicles just with mana. So this allows you to just crew your Consulate Dreadnoughts and Colossal Plows, even if you have no actual creatures in play. So what I found, and I got paired against this deck a little while ago, was that my removal was mostly useless. Now, granted, I was playing red removal, so that was part of the problem. But I just assumed that you can attack a vehicle deck by just picking off their creatures and making the vehicles be kind of stranded. It just didn't work. I mean, they were just so big, almost impossible to kill, short of actual artifact removal. And the thing about vehicles is that if they have a vehicle sitting around and then they play a creature to crew it, you can push the creature, you can try to burn the creature out, but they'll still get to crew that turn. So it's almost like they got a hit in anyway. So it was a really impressive deck, seeing how it all came together.
Yeah, it's super cool that a deck like this did so well. I'm really surprised they're not playing any of the 3-mana dwarf. That dwarf is really good with Magda. It also buffs your other dwarfs. Like it allows Veteran Motorist, for instance, to crew Peacewalker Colossus. or it itself is buffed by Magna, so it can crew Peacewalker Colossus. I feel like one of those has to be worth a slot in here. I know you had pointed out, Dan, when we were looking at early brews for this, the Lurrus is just an awesome mana dump for the 3 white you get from the Plow. I hope this list has some staying power because I love the look of it. My concern is that I think we've moved to a more black removal base in Pioneer, and this will be a historical footnote. And I do think that Fatal Push, Abrupt Decay, those are much better suited to interact with the threats in this deck.
Yeah, that may be. I was thinking Lurrus as a companion, but it turns out that, you know, maybe the Peacewalker Colossus is just too important. They're not willing to give it up. So there's 3 Lurrus, 3 Peacewalker, and 1 Embercleave that violate the Lurrus condition. Dipala, the 3-mana dwarf you mentioned, would also not work with a Lurrus companion. But maybe that's okay. You know, you do have Magda to pump up your Veteran Motorist to 4 power. And I think that just what makes this work in the way that our Magda brews were not working is that here Magda is just like a supporting player. If you have it and it lives, it's nice. But if they kill it or you don't draw it, it's fine. You know, your deck has other stuff going on.
Yeah. So I guess this deck is kind of using a rule of 8-ish with the 4 Giant Ox and 3 Peacewalker Colossus to give you reliable ways to crew your 4 Colossal Plow and 4 Consulate Dreadnought.
And then for those guys like Dan who think they can kill their creatures, eventually you draw your 1 Armed and Armored, and then you just turn on all of your vehicles and they get in there. I mean, Armed and Armored turning on like multiple Consulate Dreadnoughts is just such an insane play. That seems so exciting. It's worth noting, not only does SRAM draw when you play vehicles, it also draws when you play equipment. So the Shadow Spear to give lifelink, the Embercleave, those are both cards that trigger it. And Armed and Armored equips. So if you have an Embercleave in play and they were able to kill that creature, for instance, Armed and Armored will put that on any other creature you have in play.
Only a dwarf. It doesn't equip your Consulate Dreadnought.
Oh, fair enough.
So really cool lists. And I feel like Pioneer is actually sweet right now. As good as Control is, just the amount of innovation happening, the numbers are back up. The numbers are increasing in the leagues. There's more decks in the deck dump. And there's just a positive buzz about it. Now it's a great time, I think, to get back into Pioneer.
Yeah, before Strixhaven does something terrible to it, probably. This is the time you'll tell your kids about when you could play freaking Colossal Plow and just smoke people.
Exactly. 5 weeks until Strixhaven drops. Destroys everything we loved. That transitions us to our final piece here for this episode. We did get a sneak peek at a cycle of commands from Strixhaven. What we know about the set is that this is the Magic Universe spin on a wizarding school. Not Harry Potter. No, of course not. This is a unique Magic IP, totally different from Harry Potter or any other wizarding school you've seen. And it appears to be based on enemy color pairings, which are also totally different from the Ravnica guilds, or so we're told by Mark Rosewater. What does it all add up to? Well, we have a new command for each of the enemy color pairs to kind of complement the Dragons of Tarkir cycle. Do you guys want to just talk about all of them or some that jumped out to you more than the others?
They are all extremely exciting.
Well, the cheapest one is usually the one that demands the most attention. So Damon, tell us about Witherbloom Command.
Yeah, so this is green and a black for a sorcery. Choose 2, target player mills 3 cards, then you return a land card from your graveyard to your hand, or destroy target non-creature, non-land permanent with mana value 2 or less. What is a mana value? Well, converted mana cost was too clunky, and so now we have mana value. Moving down the list, we have target creature gets -3/-1 till end of turn, and lastly, target opponent loses 2 life and you gain 2 life.
Looking at these modes, the first one is the only one that seems guaranteed to be worth a card. And the card you're going to get is a land. So you mill it 3 from yourself, you get a land back. The fourth mode, you drain 2 life. Sure, that's probably the most common play for this. But if you ever get the second mode, you're probably getting terrific value. The second mode, picking off, I don't know what, Renin 6, other vial. But there's just like not a whole lot that can destroy. And the third mode of shrinking a creature -3/-1 at sorcery speed is very strange. Like, why -3 at sorcery speed?
Yeah, so the first mode is only a guaranteed card if you're playing Modern, just so we were very clear. It's not always drawing you a land, trust me. If you've ever played a side of Wayfinder that misses, you know what I'm talking about. I do want to point out that in a deck that really wants to mill a lot of cards, Citrus Supplier into this puts an absolute ton of cards in your graveyard. It can target the Citrus Supplier, killing it, as well as milling. So you'll have... You don't have to get the land if you don't want.
Oh no.
Oh no, you have to. Oh, that's a shame. they don't like giving you choices anymore because Magic design is garbage. So whatever. There's still be a lot of cards in your graveyard if that's something you're interested in.
Hogak's back. It's funny how this card is like a super clean answer to Arkham's Astrolabe, but I guess it just came too late.
Wow.
Yeah, one problem is that I think Renin 6 is kind of back in Modern, and you're seeing more of it in leagues than you used to. Not that it ever really went away, but Renin 6 already kind of pushes out the X1 creatures, and so a lot of your viable targets, you know, Witherbloom Command is crowded out by that. On the other hand, I mean, people are winning challenges with a bunch of Arbor Elves or Noble Hierarchs.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real problem is just that Renin 6 is a built-in 2-for-1. I don't need to hope to hit a land and hope that they've got another vial in play to complete my 2-for-1 in my Jund type of coloration. Now, obviously, not every deck wants to play red. Yeah, but I would be stunned if this card sees a lot of play.
Yeah.
I think the best case this card is awesome. I just think the best case happens much less often than you'd like.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be playing this personally, but we'll see. We now have an Izzet command called Prismari Command. This one is an instant for 1 blue-red. Choose 2. First mode, 2 damage to any target. Second mode, target player draws 2, then discards 2. Third mode, target player creates a treasure token. Fourth mode, destroy target artifact. So interestingly, the first and fourth modes are the same as the modes on Kolaghan's command, which is also a 3-mana instant. The new ones here are the loot 2 and creating a treasure. What do you guys make of this?
Yeah, so it's embarrassing that the red modes on this are exactly Kolaghan's command's red modes.
Or consistent.
They could have changed literally any unob, like 3 damage but only to a player or planeswalker or whatever. Whatever, fine. They don't have any, they're out of ideas. I think that the other two are significantly weaker than the ones that Kolaghan's command can do. However, there are some synergistic pieces. Getting a treasure, making this only 2 mana, and the treasure triggering Fatal Push is relevant in Pioneer. You don't have fetch land, so turning on Fatal Push is not always trivial. Grixis control lists have been terrible in Pioneer, but maybe that could change. Also, this targeted draw is awesome with Notion Thief. If you EOT Notion Thief on their turn and then untap and play this, that's just an insane play. But you might just argue just resolving Notion Thief is already the end of the game, so you don't need to worry too much about that, but...
That is pretty sick, though.
Yeah. This card seems very medium to me. You know, Electrolyze sees fringe play every so often, and that deals 2 and draws a card. It only has, you know, you're forced into those 2 modes. And the thing is that drawing a card in decks that like to play Electrolyze is definitely better than looting. Looting is good, and is it Phoenix? But I'm not sure if Phoenix is looking for the other modes here. And so then it's like, well, you know, deal 2. If you can ever kill a creature and kill an artifact, then that's great. But that's literally what Kolaghan's command does. And then the treasure token. Yeah, the Fatal Push idea is interesting, David. It's just like, you're not really up a card. So you're playing a 3-mana that sort of 1-for-1s and slightly helps out Fatal Push, which is fine. But, you know, just like, is it Charm? Feels pretty medium.
I'm a big fan of this one. But maybe it's because I'm high on Is It Charm again. I cast a bunch of Is It Charms in my league the other day just to draw 2, discard 2, and I didn't get a second mode. If I could have also gotten a second mode, I could have had a treasure. I mean, how awesome would that have been?
Yeah, but you did that on turn 2.
Well, no, I mean, I didn't. The game goes late. I mean, what's so great about those decks is that you can kind of hold your mana up and wait and see what you have to do. And I think even like the Dragons deck Damon was talking about would be happy with at least the option to do this. You know, hold your mana up. If you need to loot, you can do that. If you want to like ramp 3 to 5 unexpectedly and land your dragon a turn early, you can do that too. So I think this one will overperform.
Yeah, I wish it did just a little more for that ramp purpose. I don't think 3 mana, not being able to kill any creature that's relevant and then ramp to your dragon, quite does it. If it was for sure going to get a card and ramp, that would be one thing. But 2 damage is not going to kill anything. Like killing a mana elf on turn 3 and then ramping to dragon is I think, just a little too weak. But I like the idea. The surprise ramp is something I thought about, but unless you're actually looting as well and somehow that has value, maybe there's something there.
The blue-green school is Quandrix. This is the school for math magicians. So Damon, maybe we'll throw this one to you.
Okay. 1 green-blue for an instant. Choose 2, return target creature or planeswalker to its owner's hand, or counter target artifact or enchantment spell, or... put 2+1/+1 counters on target creature, or target player shuffles up to 3 target cards from their graveyard into their library. What do you think, David?
I think the best, absolute best case scenario of this is the most powerful of all of them. If you're bouncing a creature that costs, I don't know, let's just say 3 or 4 mana, and you're countering an artifact or enchantment spell of 3 or 4 mana, that's as good as any of these things get. I just think that's going to happen basically never. I think it's probably a fine defensive play if you like buff a blocker and... bounce another attacker, but Yeah, it's just in Modern, it's just not even close to the right power level. And in Pioneer, you're bouncing one mana creatures because nothing else is attacking, because it's a total Niv grind fest. So if the 2+1/+1 counters at instant speed is really valuable, then I think this card is possibly playable in Pioneer.
Yeah, this card has like a ceiling of almost being like a 3-mana Cryptic Command where you bounce and counter, but the modes have to, you know, line up just right against your opponent's spells for that to be the case. And so that means you need to be playing as a deck that plays both artifacts and creatures or whatever. And that's a little bit narrow. On the other hand, I mean, this is like a main deck anti-dredge card, kind of, with the shuffle 3 cards clause. Counter your turn 3 Shriekhorn, shuffle your Stinkweed Imps back in. I don't know.
Bouncing a Planeswalker is kind of interesting. I'm trying to think of if we've seen that before or if that would ever get used. I guess this does bounce a Velki if they did a Bring to Light for Tybalt. So maybe if they just hadn't changed the Cascade rule and just if we could hold on for a few more weeks, Quandrix Command would save us.
I mean, it is kind of cute that this bounces like your own Teferi. Like if you play a Teferi, it untaps enough mana to protect itself. So they like attack everything at it. You put it back in your hand and possibly put +1/+1 counters on something somehow that you couldn't block with. Then next you get to play Teferi and, you know, untap a bunch of mana again after it draws. I mean, there's all just like weird corner cases to try to squeeze value out of this. It just seems so much worse than a 3-mana counter spell.
All right. In Orzhov colors, Silver Quill Command, 2 white black sorcery, choose 2. The modes are target creature gets +3/+3 and flying until end of turn. Return target creature with mana value 2 or less from your graveyard to the battlefield. Target player draws a card and loses 1 life. Target opponent sacrifices a creature. So these all more or less give you a card worth of value. Maybe not the first mode, but the others do. On the other hand, these are small effects, and it's at sorcery speed.
Yeah, a 4-mana sorcery that's like a really bad 2-for-1 is just not even close. It's not even a clean draw. You have to take damage. That's insane. And I would also add like 4-mana edict is really bad. So by the time that happens, you are killing a really bad creature. So it's not, you know, a 2-mana edict compared to a 4-mana edict is a totally different card altogether.
But this card is kind of like 4-mana deal, you know, I don't know, 11 damage if you have a Consulate Dreadnought out here ready to crew and give it flying, ping your opponent for 1.
It's true.
Yeah, there you go.
Consulate Dreadnought attacks for 7, by the way.
Well, until it gets +3/+3 with flying. I don't know if you're at the card or not, David.
And hopefully they sacrifice their flying blocker.
Rounding things out, we have the most interesting one. Boros colors, Lorehold Command, 3 red, white, instant, choose 2. Create a 3/2 red and white spirit creature token. Creatures you control get +1/+0 and gain indestructible and haste until end of turn. Lorehold Command deals 3 damage to any target. Target player gains 3 life. Or sacrifice a permanent, then draw 2 cards. So 5 mana is a lot, but this is instant speed, and the combinations of these are like pretty exciting. Notable that if you combine the first 2 effects, you get a 3/2 creature that becomes a 4/2 haste with indestructible. So you kind of get a free hit with that, and your team also gets +1/+0 indestructible and haste. So you could crash in for a lot of damage that way, or you could do something very defensive, you know, Lightning Helix and sack a land, draw 2 cards. So this runs the gamut. I mean, this could be a Moldrifter. This could be a Flame Tongue Kavu. This could be like a Slash Panther type effect, surprise haste. It's all over the map.
Yeah, it's so conflicting in the sense that Boros decks typically don't get to, you know, jam out 5-mana threats. You have to, you know, maybe you can play, you know, a couple 4-mana like Hellriders or Gideons or something in your Boros aggro deck that doesn't exist and has never existed. But 5-mana like tricky modal instance is typically just not what Boros decks could play, but they also haven't really had them available. And so that's extremely interesting. This could really land as being pretty good. I don't think it'll ever be like a great card. If it costs 4-mana, then maybe it could be great. But at 5, yeah, it's exciting, but possibly poor.
Yeah, I feel like you need to tie this to another color that has other flash things to do. Otherwise, every time you just pass leaving 5-mana up, it's kind of easy for your opponent to play around the only 5-mana Boros spell that exists. I guess there's a few just mono white angels with flash. I'm trying to think of other cards that sort of typically, when you're playing flash, you know, kind of trickier threats, you're pairing that with blue. So I like this maybe in a Jeskai shell. I think all these modes are very interesting. You're just asking for a lot of mana for them. So I think I like a block, you know, chump block, kill a creature, Lightning Helix, and then draw 2 cards from the creature that's going to die anyway as my favorite mode. I'm not sure that's quite worth 5 mana though.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, one of these modes isn't really an instant speed mode, namely the pump and haste. I mean, indestructible is nice against a sweeper, but if you're going to do the thing that Dan was mentioning, where you're making a 4-2 hasty indestructible red and white spirit and buffing your team, that's not really a thing you want to do end of turn. On the other hand, yeah, this protects against Wrath, and so in that sense, it kind of does the same job as Archangel Avacyn, while also being a little bit sort of just trickier than Avacyn. And Avacyn does see play in Pioneer.
I'm trying to picture the kind of deck that could use all these modes, and I guess it would be some kind of slower control deck that used a token-generating Planeswalker or a Secure the Waste-type card, or even just like a Castle Ardenvale, but was mostly just trying to play reactive. I don't know. It's an interesting card. Not obvious where it would go, but just cool tool for the red-white colors to have. So that is our sneak peek at Strixhaven. We have probably 5 weeks left of Kaldheim, and we got a lot of cards we got to hit in that short time before Strixhaven is upon us. So we will hear more from the School of Mages in about a month or so. But until then, I think we will leave it here for the week.
Yeah, and so until next week, feel free to tweet at us with your favorite one of the four schools. I'm assuming that, Silverquill's out.
Well said. That's a wrap on episode 12 of Kaldheim Season. Tune in to our Sunday episode for our testing results with Righteous Valkyrie and brand new deck lists with In Search of Greatness. We want to give a big thank you to all of our listeners and especially to our supporters on Patreon. We are extremely lucky to have such an awesome community of brewers who make this show possible week after week. That's all for today. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time.